Sunday ambushes you. What happens if a grandparent dies? Each family member's grief is unique. You will become aware of this quickly, but the fact will stretch you and your ability to assist them. No matter whether you meet with a family of three or four or a group of eight or ten, each one is going to respond in a unique way, even though they've all been exposed to the same loss, to the same death. So if you're in a helping, caring type of ministry, have this expectation. One size does not fit all. It varies. Does everybody experience the same loss? No. Perhaps, but perhaps not. It could be that you've already experienced this in some of your own grief events. Each person's grief response is affected by numerous factors and by its DNA. It helps to look at a mourner and realize all that has come into play. Part of the difficulty will be family differences to the event, and people have different responses. It doesn't help to talk about it. You'll hear that. You can talk about it, but not with me. Let's just move on. We're doing fine. Thanks for asking. No, they're not doing fine. If you're not sharing feelings, you're not responding in a healthy way. Let's let others help us. That is healthy. Be willing to be open and let people into your life in one way or another. That's the only way we're going to be able to move on. Terminal illness. I want to talk about this a little bit because, very honestly, most of us here are going to have somebody in the family who experiences a terminal illness. I was just reflecting on it. Two, three of my family members, it was terminal. And when it's terminal, part of your grieving is going to occur before they're dying. If this goes on for a year or two, a lot of it has been experienced by you. And so your response at that time might not be a lot of emotion, a lot of crying, or anything like that. And people look at you and say, what's wrong with you? How come you're not feeling it? Oh, I felt it all right. I felt it for 4 years. Felt it for 3 years. And sometimes you feel it for maybe 20 years if there's disability in that person's life. When a family member is traumatized, the family balance is disrupted. There's a hole in the fabric of the family, but not everybody understands this. If one person is traumatized, so are the other individuals. And I talk a lot in here about trauma because we live in a culture where trauma is much more prevalent than you ever realize. For example, have you been a caregiver yet? Or have you been on the other side of having somebody care for you? We will experience somewhere in our life caregiving. And if we are the caregiver, we are prone to post-traumatic stress disorder because we tend to take care of somebody else and we don't take care of ourselves. And it's going to be very critical that you take care of yourself first in any kind of ministry that you have to anybody who is going through loss or in a caregiving kind of a situation. Some of the unique problems to consider in the family system are, how close was each family member to the dying person? What was the quality of their relationship or level of attachment? One person might be very, very close. Another person isn't. But the one who is close, what is their expectation? You need to be as close as I am. Not necessarily. Not at all. What is the grieving pattern of each person and what does each know about grief? Most people do not know about it. You live in a culture that does not talk about loss. You live in a culture that does not talk about grief. And one of the best things that you can do back at your own church, your own congregation, is to encourage your pastoral staff to preach on loss, to preach on grief, to have seminars. If you work in a large company or corporation, have you ever, in the in-service training, had classes on loss? Had classes on grief. We go in and we do a lot of that now, where you bring people together. Most of the Christian schools in Bakersfield have had in-service training on loss and grief for the teachers and for their students. We have had the opportunity to train all of the high school counselors in every high school in Bakersfield on loss and grief and trauma. Is this happening where you live? If you don't know, find out. encourage them to do this. There's so much that can be done. To what extent does each person want to be involved with a dying person at this time? Some want to be there all the time. Others don't even want to walk into the room. We all vary, and we're confronted with what's going on in my life. How does the expression of grief affect the grief of other family members? You're going to have a family, and here's one person that thinks about their grief when you talk to them about it. Somebody else, you mention grief, and they're crying for the next 10 minutes. Each is grieving, but in their own unique way. How will the family handle the after-death issues if there are differences, such as what type of funeral, disposal of remains, type of service, disposal and disbursement of clothing and personal effects, photographs shown or not shown, holidays, anniversaries, etc.? All these are going to come into play. What if half of the group wants an open casket? What if the other half doesn't? How do you resolve these things? You've got to do a lot of talking about it and be very, very open about what you are experiencing. What are the specific reasons for the grief of each family member? Okay, we want to distinguish between three things: loss, crisis, and trauma. And I think you've got space for this on the handout. First of all, loss. What does it produce? An ache, an emptiness, a sadness, a hole. Now, some losses don't incapacitate you. You still are able to go to work. Maybe you function at 80% of your capacity, but you are still functional. The same way with school. You can still go ahead and work. I remember hearing a couple of the high school students at Taft High School mention, they said, "Norm, you know, prior to this shooting that took place in the class, I knew everything. I had it memorized. Now, I don't remember anything at all. What is wrong with me?" Nothing is wrong with you. You're in grief. You've been traumatized. That's why. Then we have a crisis. Crisis throws us off balance into a state of shock, panic, and uncertainty. The best way to describe what it's like when you're in a crisis: you're out swimming in the ocean, and you're coming to shore, and you don't see that wave creeping up behind you, and all of a sudden it hits you and knocks you down. And as you're trying to get up, another wave hits you. Then the third wave hits you, and this time it rubs your nose in the sand, and you're able to crawl in. That's a crisis. You're not stabilized. You're off balance. There's disequilibrium. And then, trauma. Trauma is a wounding. It overwhelms our senses, and it rewires our brain. There's one thing I want you to remember about trauma while you're here. It's the brain that is impacted. It disrupts the functioning of your brain. You experience an emotional and a cognitive concussion. That's what you're experiencing. We'll come back to this. Now, I'm a typical man, and I'm visual. So I drew the brain as best I could. Here with the loss, it's the right side of your brain that's being impacted. That's the picture side. There's no words there, but it's like a silent movie. And when you dream at night, that's the side of the brain that you're dreaming on. And that's what's impacted with the loss. You still might function pretty well because you're not in a crisis mode, you're not in a trauma mode. But now, when you experience a crisis, you're numb, you're stunned, you're shocked, disoriented. The right side is still experiencing the loss. Now it's intensified because of the left side. And here's what happens. The right side just has pictures. It's very dependent upon the left side, which has words. But guess what will happen when you're traumatized? The left side cannot get the words across to the right side to tell you what's going on in your life and how normal it is. And you think your whole life is really come apart. I don't usually watch many series on TV, but I found a series called The Night Shift. And it's the story of the night shift at a hospital. Three of the major doctors in there were in Afghanistan in the war. And this series is just filled with a depiction of what it's like to experience trauma. And it's not just doctors over there that experience it. It's people right in our community that have experienced this, and maybe they're not even totally aware of what's happening to their life. So when I'm working with people, I show them pictures like this, and it makes sense to them. They say, wow, now I understand what's going on in my life. Okay, take a look at some losses. This stuff here, you don't need to write down. I just want to bring it to your attention so we realize that loss doesn't just happen to folks like you and me, not adults. It happens when you're a child. Okay, here are some of the losses. Loss of a favorite toy, dropping an ice cream cone in the dirt. I've seen adults cry over that. I was making an ice cream cone and I dropped the cone and my golden retriever was right there and he said, more. Not receiving an anticipated gift, a friend starts playing with somebody else. Parents decide to move away from the familiar neighborhood. A pet gets lost or dies. Divorce, mom or dad remarries. This is interesting. When you go through a divorce as a child, there are major losses. But guess what happens when mom or dad remarries? No longer are you the firstborn in the family. No longer do you have a room by yourself. You have to share it with two other strangers. Those, too, are losses. Being promoted to an advanced class and leaving your friends behind. Having your friends promoted to an advanced class and being left behind. That's a bummer. Not making the little league or the soccer team. Some of you will remember when you were a child getting picked last. Boy, there's a lot of loss connected with that one right there. Not getting invited to a birthday party. Not getting a favorite teacher of your sibling. A teacher leaving in the middle of the school year. See, you've got to see loss through the eyes of the person who's experiencing it. These are major, some of them. A classmate dies. A grandmother dies. Gaining weight. Divorce. They're discovering you were adopted. Loss of innocence. Losing a library book. Catching the tooth fairy in the act. Yeah. Okay, I want you to take 67 seconds and turn to the person next to you and identify the four most common or frequent losses that a child experiences. You can begin talking now. Seconds is not very long, but I see some hands and get some ideas about what are the most frequent losses for children. But I see some hands. Right here. Loss of a pet is one of them. Yes, sir.
In my family's life, moving.
Moving, you nailed it. Moving is another one. Yes. Okay, that's not, but that is a loss. What else?
Divorce
is another one. What else? Grandparent dies. Yeah. My granddaughter has experienced the death of three of her grandparents already. And so that's a big loss for them. But then we move into adulthood. Do we have a lot of losses? Oh, yeah. Loss of a job, retirement, that's a big one. My neighbor just retired. I don't know how many times he washes down the front lawn in a day. Good grief. Aging, job change that is not anticipated, abortion, miscarriage. Oh, by the miscarriage. You know how long it usually takes to stabilize? Anywhere from 6 to 15 months. And what if the woman, who had a miscarriage is 37. This was her fifth miscarriage, and she has no children. That loss is intensified because the window is shutting. You've got to see it once again through the eyes of that person. Stillbirth, giving a child up for adoption. And what happens if you raise that child until they're 18 and then they just want to go ahead and find their birth mother. And when they find the birth mother, they begin calling that lady mother. What does that do to the mother who raised her? Because I've run into that. Separation or divorce? Child leaving home. Child coming home. Okay? I want to talk about that because we live in what we call a boomerang generation. And we went through it. Our daughter left home not once, not twice, not three times, four times. Why is she came home with a cat? Guess what? Cat saved when she left. And the last time she left, two nights later, I got a call from my nephew in Montana. Uncle Norm, I just graduated from college. I'd like to come down there and work. Can I hang out with you for 2 weeks? Sure, Mark, come on down. 2 weeks.
Yeah.
5 months. 5 months the kid was there. And nothing was sacred. He'd listen to us talk, go in the room, he'd write a song, he'd read the words to it, he'd come out and he'd sing it. He's a gifted musician. And one of his favorite songs was, I just love it to hear the dogs gag. And I was like, good, my heart. So, anyway, we played a lot of ping pong, we did a lot of fishing. And two nights before Mark left, friends took him down to Calvary Chapel to hear Chuck Smith, and Jesus came into his life. So, he got a job at the Christian radio station. After 2 years, he called up and said, Uncle Norm, I quit my job. Okay, where are you going to go? Don't know. What? You quit a job and you don't know where you're going? Mark. And he waited. And he got a job at this little company out in Pomona called something like Focus on the Family. And my nephew, Mark Fugelberg, ended up being the director and producer of the Family News and Focus for 10 years, interacting with governors and senators and all these people. And now he's a vice president for Compassion. Who would know? Physical illness, injury, disability, terminal illness of a child, friend, lover, death of a child, friend, parent, partner, pet. Okay, there's a section here that I want us to take a look at because it's a categorization of 11 major losses. It's sort of a framework. And if you came to see me and talk to me about loss, I have these 11, you know, all the way in my brain. As you talk to me, I'm putting your losses through this. And some of you will end up all 11. It's not unusual. But we have that framework. And so one of the reasons that I want to do that is that I want to normalize for you what you're experiencing. If you talk to somebody in loss, there's just three things you got to do. And every one of you here today can do it. The first thing you do with somebody who's had a loss is, tell me what happened. Tell me your story. Let them do the talking. People say, what am I going to say? You don't have to worry about it. Take your cue from the person. Tell me your story. I want to hear your story. It might be told in two minutes. It might be told in 32 minutes. And people want to tell the story again and again and again. That's one thing we do, tell the story. Secondly, I'm going to normalize for you what you're going through so you realize you're not going wacko. You're not going crazy. You're not going over the edge. This is normal. And thirdly, I'm going to educate you what to expect for the future so you can handle it better. Three things. Tell me a story. Normalize. Educate. Every one of you can do that with a neighbor, with a person at work. Just sit there and give them your listening ear. Proverbs 18:13 says, he who answers a matter before he hears all the facts, to him it is folly and shame. James 1:19 says, be a ready listener in the Amplified Edition. Listening means you're not thinking about what you're going to say when that other person stops talking to you. You're totally tuned in. And remember, you listen with your eyes first. Because 55% of a message is nonverbal. And then you listen with your ears, and 38% of the message is tone of voice. And then you listen with your heart. And when you begin listening with your heart, you open yourself to experience pain. And that's all right because we're called to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. And sometimes I will cry. I cried at lunchtime, telling the story to a couple friends. nothing wrong with me. I don't need to be fixed. I'm normal, and so are you. So where was I? Okay, philosophy. I get off on tangents, and that's why I'm here. First loss. Real or material? Wow. But if we're Christians, should that concern us? Yeah. We all have attachments to certain material goods. The Book of Lamentations talks about the valuables that were lost, the valuables that were lost from the children of Israel. So, real and material, and that's usually the first loss as a child. And when a child loses a toy or an animal or something, what do they hear from the parents? Don't cry about it. We'll go buy you a new one. So what were they taught? Don't feel. Replace it as soon as possible. Not the best thing to do. Many are replaceable, which could mask the grief reaction. Then there's the abstract losses. The loss of love, hope, ambition, control, the loss of faith. Okay, everybody here, be honest. How many of you have ever lost love in a relationship? Let's see it. Come on. Okay? And where was the support group for you? Loss of hope when you're depressed. Loss of ambition when you're depressed or when you are burned out, the loss of control. What is the loss of face? Can somebody describe that for me? Loss of face? Yes.
Embarrassment.
Is what?
Loss of
embarrassment.
In public embarrassment? Yeah, shame. Something like that. At Talbot Seminary.
But what about respect?
Pardon?
What about respect?
Respect? Definitely. Very good. At Talbot Seminary, we've got about 1,300 students. 55% of them are Asian. And the majority of the Asian students are Korean. Anyang hasanika, komasonina. That's important statements for them. Now, you know what loss of face is for their culture? Getting an A- on an exam. You have to see the loss through their eyes and through their culture as well. That's important. Imagine your perceived losses. We think the other person no longer loves us. An elderly woman complains that her children have abandoned her, and we ask, well, why do you say that? Well, they ought to come visit me every week. Where do they live? About 400 miles away. Not realistic. Now, that can be solved with FaceTime and all sorts of other gadgets like that that I don't understand. But we also grieve for something that we never had, never will have. It's a failure to bond. An example would be the relationship that we never had with an alcoholic mother, or a brother who died in a war, or an education never required, or the dream of a lifestyle never achieved. Very important losses, but where is the support group? A company's financial reverses and the resultant changes often contribute directly to the loss of dreams, not just for the employees, but for the families. You go home and you tell the kids, we can't afford to send you to a Christian school anymore. There's no money for it. This is a big one. Relationship loss. The end of an opportunity to relate. Death, divorce, moving, end of a friendship. Let me go back to this because on the death, usually there is a closure at some point in time. What about divorce? Is there a closure if there are children? Probably not, because you've got to juggle who comes to this birthday party and goes to this graduation, and then those children go off and get married, they have children, and how do you handle all that? It's very, very difficult. People continue to grieve throughout their lifetime. This is one of my major losses. That was my first golden, Sheffield. I used him as a therapy dog, and he came into our family at a time when there was a major loss of a family member, and there was a connection there. And so he was very sharp. I'd throw things on the floor and say, Sheffield, trash. Go get the trash, put it in the trash. I taught him how to answer the phone. He'd go get the phone, he'd come back, people thought it was an obscene phone call in reverse. But very, very important loss, and it was very traumatic when he died. This is a friend of mine's son by the name of Matt. I knew Matt since birth, took him fishing a lot, spent a lot of time with him, sharp kid, graduate from college, getting married. Matt had a little bit of a dark side at times, and sometimes in that dark side he would make decisions that were not good decisions. And one day, when he was out hunting, he made a decision and he took his life. Ever have an experience where you could stand outside of yourself and see where you were standing? I have, when I got the phone call from my friend to say that Matt is in heaven. I can still remember that. It's my wife on this side and her mom who died almost 3 years ago, and it's as though the death just occurred. Because a woman's mother's death is highly significant and takes a long time to overcome. It's my daughter Cheryl, who died about 2.5 years ago, totally unexpected. And then my brother Paul. It's the first time I've used his picture here. He died about 2.5 months ago, 86. And it's been much more difficult than I ever experienced. And yet, then I realized we had 80 years of connection together. And it's very important. He owned and edited a newspaper. And so we're both writers, and we talked every week. And I get this thing, what we're going to talk about. And I call my brother, and I get the weather report of Tulsa, Montana. I wanted it? No, but it was important to him. And whenever an earthquake hit California, he called me and told me about it because he read that every day. So, but the people that we lose are very important. And besides loss, losing an image of oneself, losing what might have been, death of a dream, loss of face and shame, now I'm going to give you a challenge. Tell me what's going on here. Major loss. Anybody here get that? Any of the fellas in particular? Randolph Gardner won the gold medal in the Olympics in Australia for heavyweight wrestling. Then the next 4 years came by, but just a year before the Olympics hit, he was in a major accident and they thought he would die. He came back, went to the Olympics, won the bronze, and as he left the ring, he took his shoes off and he put them in the center of the ring to denote that he was retiring, and he wept as he walked away. Because this is what you do as a wrestler, to let people know, I'm hanging it up, I'm not going to do this anymore. You put your boots in the center. It was the most moving experience of that entire Olympic time. But that's the way you denote it. No longer will I be called wrestling. Functional loss. Oh, now we're going to meddle with some of us here with the gray hairs. Functional loss. Muscular or neurological function. I'm struggling with neuropathy in my right hand, which is impacting my piano playing because I took 10 years of classical playing or lessons growing up, and I try to play a half hour or 40 minutes a day, and so that's one of the things that I'm working on. But it can impact our sight, our hearing, our coordination, our body part, and I forgot what the last one was. Anyway. Diagnosis, disability, chronic illness. How many people in your congregation have a chronic illness? Are you aware? I think you'd be shocked. I really do. A friend of mine wrote this, a senility prayer, God grant me the senility to forget the people that I never liked anyway. The good fortune to run into the ones I knew, and the eyesight to tell the difference. And I go back one. What happens, too, when you're in good health and your partner is struggling with Alzheimer's? Or Parkinson's. And what happens when most of your friends have passed on and you don't have them anymore? In our Boone Center for the Family, one of the choice members that we had that was a real gentleman was Art Lindblad. And I got to thinking the other day, when I was younger, would I ever dream that I had had conversations with Art Linkletter? No. But we did. And one day, he said, "Norm, you know, I'm 94 years of age. All my friends have died. I don't have the time or the ability to develop new friendships." And this happens as we get older. And it is so important that as we get older, that we let the people that we love know that we love them. My brother and I would sign off with, "I love you." My male friends, several of them, when we talk together, we say, "I love you." It's so important. Role loss. Retirement, transfer, promotion, demotion, graduation, all those carry with them maybe some benefits, but boy, there's some losses there too. The systemic loss. A significant person leaves your group. Your child leaves home. A fellow worker leaves home. The family from your church has been there for 40 years. All of a sudden they retire and they move home. There's a big hole there. What about when the pastor who's been there for 25 years retires? Do you leave the congregation in grieving over this? I've been called in to do this on a number of occasions. When there's been a tragedy in the church, or there's been a just leaving it. What about if the pastor leaves and he has to because of immorality? One of the churches in my area had 4 different staff members have to leave the church because of immorality within a 10-year period of time. They called the entire congregation together and we just debriefed everybody because they were just in shock. They were just numb. And this happens. And so if there's a significant person that leaves, that hole takes a while before it is filled. Threatened loss. This is a hard one. Biopsy. Thinking of divorcing you. Downscaling. Lawsuit. Terrorism. Hurricane. Tornado. Floods. The problem with a threatened loss is this. The reality of it happening could happen. And secondly, you are probably not going to be able to do anything to prevent it. You're in a victim posture. That's right. Wow. Ambiguous loss. Now, there's 2 main losses and then a bunch of sub ones. Let me tell you the main ones. One is, there's a loved person in your life. There's an emotional connection you have with that person. You really care for them. But they're not there physically. They're missing in action. They were in the tower when it came down. They ran away. They became homeless. But you can't bring any closure to that, can you? Because the person isn't there. But reverse it. The person is now there in the home. They're there bodily. But they're into alcoholism. They're into drugs. They have Alzheimer's. Dementia. They're not there emotionally or psychologically. And so it's difficult here to deal with. And there's some others. The variations are deployment, MIA, strike, Alzheimer's, abortion, childhood abandonment, physical and emotional. The loss of childhood from physical and or sexual abuse. Family member in jail, chronic illness. Look at all the ones. How do you find a support group for these? Sometimes you just don't. And that makes it more difficult because you feel isolated. You feel all alone. Disenfranchised grief. The grief that people experience when you incur a loss that is not or cannot be openly acknowledged, publicly mourned, or socially supported. I want you to turn to the person next to you, and you have 38 seconds to come up with at least 2 examples of this last one. You can begin talking right now. Okay, but I see some hands. Oh, wow. Nobody's ever come up with that one. That's great. You lose an election. Send that in to Mr. Trump. Maybe you won it, but the winning of it is major losses, too. But that is really something. Thank you. Okay, what else could we have? Yes, ma'am.
If someone's raped.
Pardon?
If someone is raped.
Somebody is raped. Abortion. Yeah, there could be that. What else?
Incest.
Pardon?
Incest.
Incest, yeah. What about the loss of a friend? You see, some of us have relationships with friends that are far closer than relatives. We've all got relatives in our life that we've inherited and we wish we'd been left out of the will. You know? We don't have anything. You know, we see them once a year. Who are you? You're a stranger. But not the friendship that you cultivate. That is critical. What about the loss of a pet? Yeah, you've got those as well. So these are the different losses. Now, three types of disenfranchised grief. The relationship is not recognized. The loss is not recognized. Another one. The griever is not recognized. Maybe we think that because of some mental problem, they're not capable of grieving. Okay. Don't have to write anything down. I want to give you an example of a timeline of grief, and I'm going to use this gentleman by the name of Eric Smith. He was born in 1964, and his first loss was the loss of a dog. They moved. His dog died, and they moved. A friend moved away. Parents divorced. Lost partial vision in his eye, but the dream of playing Major League Baseball was over. Discovered a tumor in his leg, and it was benign. And his wife miscarried, job transferred to the East Coast. Closest friend died in an accident. Mother diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Uncle died in the Trade Center, never found. And then his daughter left for school. When you see the dark line, the dark vertical line, that indicates this loss has not been resolved. The length of the vertical lines up and down indicate the intensity of that loss. So, you've got on your paper a horizontal line. And what I'm going to ask you to do now is to begin the process of writing your own loss history. Start with your birthday. You don't have to worry about it. Nobody is going to read it, so they don't know how old you are. Start with your birthday and begin the process of identifying your losses, and then I will give you the next set of instructions so you can begin. this time and ask, what are you experiencing as you reflect upon the losses in your life? What's going on inside of you? Could I see some hands? Yes.
Realizing there's way more than I thought.
Realizing there's... Okay, there's way more than I thought and things that I didn't recognize as losses. Yeah?
Still just have to move on.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Reignites some of the feelings and the grayness returns.
Some of the feelings return, yeah. What else? Yes?
Memories of the individuals.
Memories of the individuals. Yeah. Anything else?
I think I can remember those dates specifically where I don't really remember what year did we move here or why this car.
Okay, you remember the event. There will be a range of responses as you begin this process, and I mentioned as you begin, because one of the things that we learned is that it's important to take more time for this. So we encourage everybody to leave this out for the next week, and every day go back to it and look at it, and you will be amazed at what pops into your mind that I never thought that was a loss, or I thought I had taken care of it, and I'm feeling as though it just reoccurred. So take the next week and finish that bottom part of it for your loss history. Then return to this, and on the top part, do a history of the blessings that you've experienced in your life. Because life is a mixture of joy and sorrow. They're not opposites. They're intermingled together. And once you do this, you will have a balance, because some people live in denial. Everything's wonderful. Other people live just for the pain. It's a mixture, and you want to look at it in that way.
My husband died 8 months ago. We were married 70 years.
Wow.
And he was a minister, and he counseled a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And now I want to know, because I have gone through, this is the first time in my life, where I love someone so deeply, and I lost sleep and all this. And so I wanted to learn how I can empathize
okay.
with people now. And that's why I'm in this class.
I'm glad you're here. You were married for 70 years, and your husband died 8 months ago. So you are fresh in your grief.
Yes, I am.
What was your husband's first name?
Ross Long.
His first name?
Minister Ross Long.
Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I found something, and if you have time, I'd like to read it to you. That's helped me. Okay.
Okay.
This is from a very old book that was given to me, and I found it after he passed.
Okay. Turn a little bit and
turn up
your volume a little so people can hear this.
Well, maybe you'd like to read it.
Okay. Somebody want to read it up to me?
But that's helped me more than anything.
Oh, good.
But I never understood until I've gone through the grief with someone that close to me. And that's why I'm here, because now I can relate to other people.
You really can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No loss is ever wasted in God's economy. Okay. Let me read this. In the next room.
Mm-hmm.
It's called In the Next Room. I have only slipped away into the next room. I am I and you are you. Whatever we were to each other, that we are still. Call me by my old familiar name. Speak to me in the easy way which you always use. Put no difference in your tone. Wear no forced air or solemnity of sorrow. Laugh as we always laugh at the little jokes we enjoy together. Play, smile, think of me, pray for me. Why should I be out of mind because I'm out of sight? I am but waiting for you, for an interval, somewhere very near, just around the corner, all is well. Thank you.
And the next one is good, too. It's by another person. This is very long ago.
The next one is called the Day of Death. The Day of Death is when two worlds meet with a kiss. This road going out, the future world coming in. Thank you. One of the losses we talked about earlier was terminal. But what if it's sudden? What does that mean? I am part of a chaplain group called Wikimedia Chaplains. We're a national organization. We were at Katrina for 11 months. We serve at the Kern Medical Center, which is the trauma center in Bakersfield. And much of our work is with the sudden death, because we work in the ER room. And so this impacts people. And it's important to know about this, too. The capacity to cope is diminished because shock overwhelms you. At the same time, you have all these stressors that are added. The loss doesn't make sense and can't be understood or absorbed. Sudden loss or sudden death usually leaves a survivor with a sense of unreality that may last a long time. Don't try to put a time limit on if anybody asks you how long is this going to occur. Basically, longer than we ever anticipated. Symptoms of acute grief and physical and emotional shock persist for a prolonged period of time. It fosters a stronger than normal sense of guilt expressed in if only statements. If you struggle with that phrase, if only, one of the best things you can do is to take a piece of paper and write if only and then finish it. Write it again, if only, and finish it. And keep writing until there's nothing left to say after the if only. That's the way that you can drain this. In sudden loss or death, the need to blame someone for what happened is extremely strong. And if you're trying to help somebody, they could turn around and blame you. That's not unusual. There's a profound loss of security and confidence in the world, which affects all areas of life and increases many kinds of anxiety. It involves medical and legal authorities. If the legal department gets in there, or if the police gets in there, sometimes it prolongs it for months. Sometimes getting the death certificate takes weeks, months, and everything is held up at that particular time. Or autopsies even, because of an accident. Sudden death or loss elicits a sense of helplessness on the part of the survivor. The loss cuts across experience. To sum this up, what your relationship was like during the previous 3 months before the death is what you focus on. You might have had 30 years of a good relationship and the last 3 months were terrible. All you remember is the terrible. Or reverse it. It was terrible for 30 years. It was good the last 3 months. And that's all you remember. It leaves the survivors with many regrets and a sense of unfinished business. Once again, if you have regrets in any kind of a relationship, you write down, I regret, and finish it. Then you write down again, I regret, and finish it. Then you do it again, I regret, and finish it. To make sure I cover this point, I'm going to mention it now. One of the most helpful things that you can do when you've had a major loss is handwrite out the story. Not type it, handwrite it. I write my books longhand. And I do better. And I never realized why until I did all my research on trauma. Because it's bringing both sides of the brain together. My first 3 trips back from 9/11 on the airplane, I spent 3 hours handwriting out the story. It was my own personal debriefing. I had to get it out. That was one reason. The second reason was I knew when I got home, everybody's going to ask, Norm, what was it like? Tell me about it. Well, a lot of stuff I didn't want to talk about. So when they asked, Norm, what was it like back there? Well, thank you for asking. Here. And I gave them 5 pages, single space. I mean, I'm a writer, so bummer. Anyway. There's the need to understand why it happened, and this is where people will begin questioning, why? God, why? Why now? Why this? Why should this happen? It tends to be followed by a number of major secondary losses. and the death can provoke post-traumatic stress responses. We talked to you about secondary losses. Here we have a situation, an example of a couple that's been married for about 35 years, and the husband dies. And people say, oh, she lost her husband. Yeah, she lost her husband, but what are the other losses that occurred because she lost her husband? Let me show you. Loss of a friend, provider, handyman, cook, lover, bill payer, gardener, laundry person, companion, confidant, sports partner, mentor, checkbook balancer, prayer partner, mechanic, source of inspiration or insight, identity, wow, teacher, motivator, counselor, business partner, protector, errand person, organizer, encourager, in-law support, couples class, financial adjustment, social adjustment, feeling of safety, tax preparer, couple friends. Wow. That's what happens. And especially couple friends, if you were a couple. Because you're now a single person and a threat. And see, unless you identify a lot of these ahead of time, you're going to get ambushed by one after another. And so it's important to write them down. It's really interesting, about 3 months after my wife died, I got a letter in the mail that said, H. Norman Wright - widower. And I bristled. How dare you call me that? I can call me that, but you can't. But that was a different role. Now, sometimes people say, is there any value? Is there any purpose in loss? Well, yes, there can be. Let's take a look. Loss can strengthen our faith. See, I don't share this with people right at the beginning. Down the road, we will begin looking at the purpose of loss after we've stabilized. Then, loss can produce maturity. In Romans chapter 5, what does it talk about in terms of the character qualities? They are there. As we suffer, we enter into the suffering of our Lord and become more Christ-like. When you experience loss, you will discover the extent of the comfort of God. And God can use what you've experienced to help someone else. This is what I have found again and again and again. 2 Corinthians 1. Blessed be the God, Father of our Lord, the Father of sympathy, and the God of every consolation and comfort and encouragement. And with that same comfort and consolation and encouragement, we will be able to console and comfort and encourage others. That is what we can learn through this. Now, a biblical perspective, purpose of loss. My wife and I lived on this for 22 years. Count it or consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, for the trying and testing of your faith produces endurance or patience. The word consider or count can mean an internal attitude, and should be of heart and mind, that causes the trial and circumstance of life to affect us either beneficially or negatively. In other words, we have a choice. It could be one or the other. The verb tense means a decisiveness of action, not a passive, that's life, that's all you can do, nothing you can do about it. That's the way the cards fall. No, that's not what it's saying at all. What it is saying is make up your mind to regard adversities as something to welcome or be glad about. It's an attitude. We have two children, Cheryl and Matthew. When Matthew was born, he appeared to be a very normal-looking child. And then after a few weeks, my wife came in and said, have you noticed that when we walk through the room, his eyes don't track with us? And I was like most men, I didn't notice. And no, I didn't notice. So I noticed, yeah. So he'll catch up, not a big deal, not a problem. Well, time went on, and every aspect of his development was very slow. But we kept saying, it's not a big deal. They'll catch up. But inwardly, we knew that something was wrong. And it was like the passage in Proverbs, anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down. There was a weight. And in 8 months, the first grand mal seizure hit us. And they continued. And so we put Matthew into the care of Dr. Metzke's at UCLA. And after the testing, he brought us in and said, well, the best I can tell you, for some reason, there was a problem in the development of his brain. It didn't develop properly. And then at birth, there was brain damage for some reason. We don't know why. The best I can tell you is that Matthew might become a 2-year-old mentally. And on the other hand, he might not. And we were sent home with that. We knew why it was that parents of disabled children, 80% of them divorce. So we didn't want to be that, and so we had to learn patience and rely upon his word. And when it took Matthew 2.5 years to reach out to grab something, we didn't take it for granted. We thank God. That's a sign of progress. And we prayed for Matthew to walk for 3.5 years. And one night when he stood up in front of us and took 4 steps, he plopped down and I made a very spiritual pronouncement. Wow, isn't that neat? So did my wife. And our daughter said, why don't you stop right now? Thank God for answering this prayer, which we did. I am indebted to my son for making me fully human, because I was like most men. I was raised emotionally handicapped. I didn't know what feelings were. I didn't cry. But all those barriers that I had were ripped away, because Matthew taught me to feel and he taught me to cry. Matthew taught me to be different in my counseling. Because Matthew didn't have a lot of words. He couldn't communicate like you and I. He'd rub our hand against his ear. He'd rub his head against us. He'd do something like that. And I learned to watch him nonverbally. And when I went into the counseling office, if you came in, I learned to listen to you with my ears, with my eyes. And I heard what you couldn't put into words. And my son taught me that. That was Matthew. He changed our life. When he was about 8, we were dealing with a 65-pound infant. And my wife was getting worn out. And we felt led to place Matthew. But it had to be in a Christian facility, because I worked in the state facilities. And so we found Salem Christian Home in Ontario, California. And we took Matthew out there, and they looked at him and said, yeah, he'll fit. We'll put him on the waiting list. What waiting list? Well, the waiting list that everybody goes on is 1 to 5. It sounded like a jail sentence. And so we waited. And they called us. We're ready for Matthew bringing. We went through several emotional upheavals where the funding was not ready and we had to wait for 8 months. And the room was not ready. And one after another. And one day, everything clicked and we took Matthew out there. And we put his stuff away. We hugged him and said goodbye and we're driving away. And I looked at my wife and said, how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. How are you? I'm doing fine too. What's wrong with us? Why? We just let loose of our son for the rest of his life, and here we are, just with peace in our hearts, and then we realize, wait a minute, he allowed us those up and down upheavals where we could get rid of the feelings and deal with our emotions in advance so that when we let loose of him, we had this peace and calmness. And you know, at one point we wondered, what was going on in our life? Because prior to Matthew ever coming into our life, I was at seminary, and I didn't know that you were not supposed to tell your professor that you didn't know what to write a thesis about, because they would assign you a pet project. And guess who did what? And I'll never forget Dr. Price saying, Norm, sit down. You're going to write a thesis on the Christian education of a mentally retarded child, of which I knew nothing. And I went to schools and hospitals and classes and read books and everything, and I wrote the thesis. We got out of there. I went on staff at the church. I entered a graduate program at Pepperdine. And when I was assigned to get my school psychologist credential, I had to put in 500 hours of internship in the school district. And they assigned me the testing and the placement of the retarded students in the district. My church discovered what I was doing, so they said, Norm, why don't we develop a ministry to the retarded children and their families? And I knew what the word we meant. I got it. So for 6 months, that's what I did. During which time, my wife and I had the most significant conversation of our entire marriage. Isn't it interesting that we're having so much exposure to retarded children and learning so much about them? Could it be that God is equipping us for something that will occur later in our life? Within a year, we had a son whose name was Matthew, which means God's gift, or gift from God. And so Matthew was with us until he went out to the home when he was about 22. He developed reflux esophagitis, you know, the regurgitation of the stomach. And he lost 10% of his body weight in a month. We'd seen a lot of progress. When he came home, he didn't forget us. He learned how to feed himself. Half the food fell on the soap, on the floor. The dogs loved him. And we had all these experiences. And now, this. So the doctor said, we'll do surgery. So they did. And it didn't work too good. So a week later, they did surgery again. And now he was on a Stryker bed, on a ventilator, and on 8 tubes. And day after day, we waited. And on the Ides of March, March 15th, we got a call from the hospital. Very generic call. You need to be here immediately. That's it. And we knew what it meant. And we walked in. And the doctors looked at us and said, Matthew's heart and lungs are going to begin to diminish in the next few minutes. And I watched the monitors begin to diminish. And the most incredible sense of loss hit us, coupled with joy by what my wife said. You mean today is the day that Matt will be with Jesus? And the doctor smiled and he said, yes, he will be. And within an hour, he was gone. We were driving 32 miles each way on Sunday to go to Hollywood Presbyterian Church, where I had grown up. And we drove there because our pastor was Roy Ogilvie, and we are really blessed by him. And he didn't ask service. He said, Joyce and Norm, Matt doesn't walk funny anymore. He doesn't have a few words. He's got a vocabulary. And why is it that after Matt went to be with the Lord, about 60% of all my counseling since then has been with parents who have lost children? They come in and they say, Norm, you understand this. You get it. Nobody else does. And so Matthew has impacted literally thousands of people throughout the country. Never wasted. We're going to take about a 10-minute break, and let me tell you what we will first talk about when we get back. I'm a bookaholic. I believe in homework. There are a lot of resources out there. You all have a order form. And what we do in our seminars, instead of bringing a pile of books, we bring a sample of each one, and I'm going to talk to you about a number of them and how they can be used. And what you do is simply order them off of this order form, and you pay with a check or you put the card number on there. You turn it in, we mail it to you postage free. That way, I don't have to bring a ton of books. You don't have to take home books. We just deal with it in that way because there's so much for you to learn now compared to 25 years ago. So we will do that. We'll take a 10-minute break. And I want to thank you for sharing with us this reading. And we all feel for you with your loss. It's a difficult journey. And I don't know how people do it without the Lord. But He is our gift. He is our joy. So let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come on back and go to work. Oh, before you go, I have one other thing. This is a picture of Matt. There he is. Okay, see you in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Hi. Sir, I'm Sherry Creed.
Hi.
Pleasure to meet
you.
Thank you. I work with orphans in Kenya regularly. I'm just a volunteer, but I have got this man, we have a man over here, and he's done some counseling training through different Kenyan pastoring schools.
Okay.
I would love, I'm going May 22nd. I would love to take him some books because he goes and helps with our children.
Okay.
I need to know what you would recommend. So
when you hear what I say, I hear you.
So all of that would be what I would be good to
you
take to him for orphans. Perfect. That's what I mean.
Oh,
no Pepsi.
Ooh, nice and cold.
He asked for Pepsi, but
thank you.
Now, see, I'm exactly opposite. I always want the Coke.
Oh,
I
want the
Pepsi,
Pepsi
challenge
but,
a long time and Coke one.
Is there anything that's like we have stuff around ways we might have different
also assisted them.
The kid's journey of grief. That's going to be important.
Okay, because they're young and this is their third time that she's.
How is the weather in here? Is it too cold, too hot? What? Is it fine?
I'm fine.
Okay. I always ask that in England because we have different capacities.
So the next day, I call that day. And you have to go check on the center. The morning, where they did everything right. They had all 250 employees come into a room. And the staff said, hold them. It's over here. All day long. That same deal. They sent everybody home for a month, which was the worst thing they could do. Because you couldn't talk to one another. You couldn't. And then when they came back, and they said, so everybody came up to the street, just the right question.
So they went to party. They had student teachers go out to small churches. And he could get that all the time.
This is for. By my wife. It's her first little book called The 1 Minute Counselor for Women.
And basically what she did, she developed a program of one-minute mentoring where maybe another lady calls you in the afternoon and you don't have an hour to talk to her. What can you do in about 5 minutes? And she had an example the other day where she prayed over the phone with somebody for a couple of minutes and it just did wonders for her. And so it just gives some guidelines like that. Now, basically, what you have several copies of and put in your purse, in your attaché case, briefcase, whatever, is called Experiencing Grief. We go through so many of these. Every time I fly out, I have two or three in my briefcase, and when I get home, usually they're not there. Because I'm an eavesdropper. I'll listen to people in the airport, I'll watch them, and if I find anybody that's struggling or has a friend that's struggling, I just give them this and I say, maybe this book would help. When you're ready, read it. And when you read it, if you don't remember anything you read, that's normal. It might take four times before it sinks in. That's okay. But don't say, you've got to read this right now. No, not at all. Now, the new development of the book Experiencing Grief is that we now have this on recording, on CDs. And this is going to be helpful because sometimes when you're in grief, it's hard to read and comprehend, but when you can hear it again and again, that will help. The last book I wrote was called When the Past Won't Let You Go. This is trauma in our everyday life. And it's basically what I've learned over the last 10 years about trauma. A book for those that have lost their spouse. It's called Reflections of a Grieving Spouse. And basically, this is my journaling that I did after my wife died. And sometimes I would sit on the floor and I would write and I'd begin to wail. My two golden retrievers had come in to take care of me and everything. So, a very personal book. This book, Experiencing the Loss of a Family Member, it deals with every relationship you have, whether it's a spouse, a sibling, parent, child, pet, friend, and actually, if you have this book and you're working with other individuals, they don't need the whole book. They just need that one chapter. You have permission to, you know, run that chapter off and hand it to them along with a little Experience and Grief book, and that's all they need. And that way they can make better use of this. If you've lost a child for any reason, death, disappearance, disability, whatever, it's called Missing the Child You Love. It deals with the loss of any aspect of a child's life. And then, this is a seminar that I do. It takes 3.5 hours. It's called Recovering from Loss and Grief. And many churches are using this not just as a seminar for people to come to, but for those that are disabled, those that are at home. They can't get out. They take it there. I have found over the last 30 years the best way to teach people how to counsel and grief is to watch live counseling. This series, Helping Those in Grief, Crisis, and Trauma, was put together 3 years ago. It's 9 sessions of actual live counseling. That's the best way to learn because you have to watch it not once, not twice, maybe 3 times, and then you realize what you're missing. So we use this a lot. And then there's some laminated material back there because we found it helps to have these if we're in the helping profession. We can make use of these cards here. And this one, the large one, is what I learned about trauma over the last 10 years and after reading 40 books on it. It's all put together so that you can just summarize it and not have to spend all the same amount of time reading. If you're working with children, this is for children 5 to 12. It's an interactive coloring book. The Art Services has an addition for the dependents of those in the Armed Service. And the Army also translated this into one of the Iraqi languages as well. So they're really reaching out to ministry. Children are the forgotten grievers. Finally, if you're working in the church and you want to teach a class, this is what you have right here. It's a We also send out with this the PowerPoint. So it comes with the PowerPoint. You can just use it like that. It's called Helping Others Recover. It's on the back part of the order form. And basically, all you do is indicate which ones you want. You fill it out in detail. You use a credit card. You put the number on there. We protect those numbers. We send all this material out to you, postage free. So that's it. And if you have any other questions, you can catch it afterwards and pass these on. We'll take them back there.
Thank you.
Got it? Okay. If you're doing any kind of ministry, lay ministry, professional, well, the one book you get is the Kelsey Jackson. The first one that I mentioned, these people call the Red Book. So, okay, want to cover some more material with you? We're going to talk about grief now, what it's really like, because it's really important that we understand it so that we can pass this understanding on to others and realize that I don't need to be fixed because I'm not broken. You know? Okay, taking a look at what the Bible has to say, the English word grief originally comes from an Anglo-French meaning injustice, calamity, or heaviness. There are some 22 words translated in the King James Version of the Bible as grief, grieve, to be grieved, etc. Its definition can express a sense of weakness and sometimes speaks of a deep sickness in the soul. And boy, people relate to that and say, yeah, I understand that, all right. Isaiah 53:10 defines Jesus' grief as meaning to crush him terribly. It can mean weariness of toil, suffering, pain, bitterness, and on from there. In Psalm 73:21, for my soul was grieved, in Hebrew means was infirmed. In Acts 4:2 and 16:18, the word is translated to groan or sigh. And many say, yeah, that's what I do. The uses and instances of the word grief are notably less frequent in the New Testament, which is significant because Christ came to conquer death and comfort all who were grieving. He came to give a garland of praise for ashes, joy for mourning, a garment of praise for a spirit of heaviness, and of course, to turn our mourning into dancing. This was written by a friend, Susan Vanderbilt, who has a book out for those who are widows. Okay, the crazy feelings of grief. Now we get to them. The crazy feelings of grief are actually the same response to grief. The following examples are all symptoms of normal grief. Now, this is printed out for you. You will get a copy of this when you leave today. And you can run it off, and I encourage you to run off several copies that have handy. All right? Okay, what are the crazy feelings? Distorted thinking patterns, crazy, irrational thoughts, fearful thoughts. Fear is a big factor in grief. Because you know what we're afraid of? We're afraid that we're never going to get over our grief. We're also afraid that the people who are now supporting us and caring for us are going to disappear. And guess what? They do. And we're also afraid that our loved one will be forgotten. That is why I ask people the name of their loved one, so that we can use it. And a pastor taught me something. A young pastor said, when he gets back from a memorial service, he writes the name of the person who died in his calendar every 3 months for 2 years. And I've done that up to 3 years. See, we want to continue on. Like the one lady that we worked with in our counseling who had lost her 6- and 7-year-old to death because her husband killed him and tried to commit himself and bundle it. But those two little boys were in a Christian preschool at Lakewood Baptist Church. And the 31 mothers in that preschool banded together and brought Liz and her 6-month-old baby dinner every night for 1 year. That is ministry. But too often, when 3 months hits after grief, it's like the Bermuda Triangle. Everybody disappeared. And we need to continue to minister for a long period of time. Feelings of despair and hopelessness, out of control emotions, or then the next day, you're numb. And you vacillate back and forth, which kills everybody. Changes in sensory perceptions, sight, taste, smell, increased irritability. We can get angry for no reasons. We may want to talk a lot, and the next day, don't want to say a word, which confuses other people. They don't understand that, which is why everybody needs to be taught about grief and loss. Memory lags and mental short circuits. You're talking to somebody, and in the midst of talking to them, what was I talking about? Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I mean, that happens to me. I'll ask somebody a question, and they go off for about 5 minutes and then stop and say, Norm, what was your question? And I hope to heaven I remember. And if I don't, I say, oh, keep on talking, you're doing fine. Or what do you remember hearing me ask you? You know, I have to fake it because I listen to people, but I don't always listen to me. Inability to concentrate. When you're in grief, watch your driving. This is the time you're most likely to get into an accident or get a ticket. And many times when I said that, somebody's hand goes up and said, you're too late, Norm. Driving over here. Obsessive focus on the loved one, losing track of time, increase or decrease of appetite and or sexual desire, difficulty falling or staying asleep. And we'll come back to this. Okay? Dreams in which the deceased seems to visit the griever, or you wish they would come into your dreams. Nightmares in which death themes are repeated. If this occurs in your life or with somebody that you know, what you do is at nighttime, you sit by the edge of the bed and you write out the nightmare, and when you get to the ending, you write a new ending. And for some reason, this tends to change your response, and you don't have the repetitive nightmares anymore. Can't always explain why some things work. Physical illness like the flu, headaches, or other maladies, your immune system has been compromised, and you need to make sure that you are washing your hands a great deal and that you protect yourself. Three of the main places where you pick up germs the most, railings going up and downstairs, at the gas pump, your cell phone. It is the worst culprit. They now have an Amazon, a little gadget that you can buy for about $29, where you put your cell phone in it, and for 5 minutes, it kills the germs that are on there. It's the same type of a gadget that they use in ER rooms to sterilize the different instruments. Because every time you phone somebody, then you put it down, what did you touch in between? There's more germs there. During the fall and the winter, when I go to church and the greeter is there, I put my Bible in my right hand and they can just touch it. And that way I don't have to shake hands with them, because if I shake hands with them, I just shook hands with 200 people that went through it before. And I don't want all the germs. And so you have to take care of yourself. Shattered beliefs about life, the world, and even God. And if I'm working with somebody and at some point they don't bring up where was God in all of this and why God, I will read that myself, because it's a good question. It's lamenting. That's why we give that book out, so that people can understand that it's all right to do this. Sleep. Now, don't worry about copying all this stuff down. It's printed out, and you can take it with you. But I've listed a number of the passages about sleep. When you lie down, you shall not be afraid, lest you shall lie down, and your sleep shall be sweet. You will not be afraid when you go to bed, and you will sleep soundly through the night. If I'm sleepless at midnight, I spend the hours in grateful reflection. When my anxious thoughts multiply within me, your consolations delight my soul. I will lie down and sleep in peace. In a dream, a vision of the night, a and sound sleep falls on men. Then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction out of the book of Job. And the next is a prayer. Dear God, we give thanks for the darkness of the night wherein lies the world of dreams. Guide us closer to our dreams so that we may be nourished by them. Give us good dreams in memory of them so that we may carry their poetry and mystery into our daily lives. Grant us deep and restful sleep that we may wake refreshed with strength enough to renew a world grown tired. We give thanks for the inspiration of stars, the dignity of the moon, and the lullabies of crickets and frogs. Let us restore the night and reclaim it as a sanctuary of peace, where silence shall be music to our hearts and darkness shall throw light upon our souls. Good night. Sweet dreams. Amen. This is printed out. And what I do with this, with the passages of Scripture and the prayer, say if you were struggling to sleep, I'd like you to take this and sit on the edge of the bed, and just before you turn on the light, I want you to read this out loud, then turn out the light, and you'll find your sleep might be changed. Certain things to avoid doing. Do not watch TV the last hour. Do not read from a Kindle, because it has an impact upon the emotions of the brain. Do not have a clock in the bed. Keep it out. Don't exercise just before you go to bed. A number of little things like that will make a difference in terms of your sleep. But this is important because it's putting into your mind the sufficiency of the Word of God. It will make a difference. Patterns of grief. Some individuals are intuitive griefers. For them, feelings are intensely experienced. They want and they need to express them. And for an intuitive griever, feelings are like rich technicolor. But then, some individuals are what we call instrumental grievers. You ask them, how are you doing with your grief, with my grief? Let me think about it. Because they're left-brain individuals is what they are. And so they think of their grief more than feel. Feelings are less intense. For them, feelings are like pastels, not rich, vibrant colors. And it's okay. Either one of these. And one of the things to keep in mind, never compare your grief with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, and it's all right. And if somebody seems better in 3 months and you're taking 10 months, that's okay. That's all right. Trauma. When time doesn't heal all wounds. Vincent van Gogh said the sadness will never go away. Which is interesting because he grew up as a Bible teacher and went down into the mines with the miners and taught them. His father was a pastor as well. But eventually he came to the place where couldn't go on anymore. And the last words that were said, this is Brother Helen, were the sadness will never go away. And that's what people feel like who are traumatized. I am frightened inside. The terror of death has attacked me. I am scared and shaking and terror grips me. I said, I wish I had wings like a dove and I would fly away and rest. I would wander far away. We call this dissociation. But the Word of God talks about as people in trauma try to do this. How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day a sorrow in my heart? Out of the Book of Psalms. Common themes of trauma can strike anyone. Leaves us feeling unsafe. It involves a loss. It makes us feel overwhelmed. Is often unspeakable, and trauma can change or challenge our view of God. This is what occurs. Trauma produces hyperarousal, hyperalertness, and hypersensitivity. You're just really on edge. You drop a book next to some when I was working with the kids out of Taft High School, we talked about things like this. And two or three of them said they went hunting with their dad the week before. And it wasn't the sound. It was the smell of the gunpowder. And I never had that, that happen before. So that was different. Those traumatized often re-experience the trauma. It leads to feelings of helplessness. It doesn't make sense. That's what's so confusing. You know, why is this happening now? Definition of trauma: response to any event that shatters your safe world so that it is no longer a place of refuge. It's more than a state of crisis. It's a normal reaction to abnormal events that overwhelm a person's ability to adapt to life, where you feel powerless. And this is how they describe it. Trauma is the response to any event that shatters. Okay, I repeated that. Okay, trauma creates chaos in our brain and causes an emotional as well as a cognitive concussion. Memory lapses. Can't distinguish real from false threats. Verbal deficits. Hyperstartle response. ADD, person feels that way. Gotta go, they can't sit still, they're just constantly on the go. Characteristics of post-traumatic stress, here are the symptoms. Flashbacks, where you feel as though you're experiencing it again, and you're not. But it's like you're there, and no amount of talking talks you out of it. You have to do things with them, right? Okay, your feet are on the floor, you feel that? Okay, reach out your hand and touch the wall. The wall wasn't there before. And just little things like this. Traumatic dreams. Memory disturbing. Your memory is not good at all. Persistent, intrusive recollections. How many of you have ever had a song get stuck in your mind? Okay? You know what I'm talking about. That's an intrusive thought. It gets stuck in your mind. Self-medication, anger, irritability, days, numb experience, panic attacks, phobias, startle response, hypervigilance. Finally got mine. That's what I experienced. I was driving home from Biola, and it was a road that was parallel to the train track. And up here on the stage road was the bars that, you know, go up and down like that. Well, there was space in between so that if you got impatient, you could drive up and go through there. And cars were doing that. And on my left ear, I could hear the Amtrak train coming. And it got closer, and I saw a little VW bug starting to go across. And this is so weird. In my mind, I saw them hitting before it happened. And I'm sitting there in line yelling at the train to stop, and it hit that little bug, and it just smashed it, and it went down the track. And I got out of line with it and called 911 and stammered and told them what happened. And I drove home a different way, praying, crying, the whole bit. Get home, and wouldn't you know it, my wife comes out of the house with our daughter who's 15 and a half, and they're going to her piano lesson, and Cheryl was going to drive. Or so she thought she was. I walked by her and said, Cheryl is not driving anywhere today. And I walked in the house for the next 10 years. And I walked in the house. And they looked at me like, what's his problem? And walked after me. Well, and I was walking around in there and talking and getting it out and everything. And so, calm down. Well, who was it who 10 times a week drove over that train track? And I did that for several years. And who was it that got 100 feet from that train track and started to slow down? And came to a stop and went both ways and went over. Did I intend to do that? No. Did I plan to do that? No. Was it on my mind? No. It was trauma that was making me hyper-vigilant. And even to The rest of the story was that young Viola student did not put on her seatbelt, which threw her in the back seat and saved her life. Her attendants were severed. She was a concert violin player. And a couple years later, she put that violin on the floor and just committed herself to the Lord. And there was a healing to her. And so out of that, we see God's work even then. But that's what happened. Is there something wrong with me that I was hypervigilant? No. That's what you can expect. And people need to understand this. There are so many more traumatized people in your congregation who never went to war, but they grew up in a family where they were traumatized. I'm talking about that in a minute. Complex trauma. What is complex trauma and what makes it different than other forms? Complex trauma generally refers to traumatic stressors that are interpersonal. They are premeditated, planned, and caused by other humans, such as violating and or exploitation of another person. Interpersonal traumatization causes more severe reaction in the victim than does that which is impersonal, the result of a random event or an act of God, such as a disaster or a building collapse or something like that. When trauma occurs within the family, between family members, or in other close contexts that involve significant roles and relationships, it is usually repeated and can become chronic over time. Child abuse of all types within the family is the most common form of chronic interpersonal victimization and complex trauma. Because the child is traumatized, either sexually or physically, by someone that they knew, family, or friend, and it's repeated, there's not any time for them to recover. So they engage in dissociation where their mind goes elsewhere during that particular time. And so if a child is traumatized when they're about 5 or 6, emotionally they are stunted at that age. They do not develop emotionally anymore. And so now they're 14. And they're acting like a 5 or 6 year old, and somebody says to them, act your age. They are acting their age. And sometimes we have what we call the brown squirrel effect. I don't know if you've ever been out in the country someplace where there's colonies of brown squirrels, but there will be brown squirrels that are what we call sentries, and they can sit up. And you look at them and they're moving around constantly, like this, jerking around. You go into a classroom of 5 or 6 year olds, and all the kids are playing or whatnot, but there's some children that are acting like this. Is that ADHD? Is that ADD? Or could they be a traumatized child? And it's something that teachers are beginning to be taught to notice. Because it probably could be a problem. So that's how that occurs. Okay, rather than creating conditions of protection and security within the relationship, abuse by primary attachment figures instead becomes the cause of great stress and creates conditions of gross insecurity and instability for the child, including misgivings about the trustworthiness of others. And so that's why we have to go back and help them deal with them. That one book back there, The Past Doesn't Let You Go, is very, very critical, especially for staff members to become aware of this and to pass it on to people in the congregation. Okay. This is pretty much summarizing what I just said at this time. This is important. Whatever the case, the victim does not have adequate time to regain emotional equilibrium between occurrences and is left with the knowledge that it can happen again at any time. And these are children that live with a tremendous amount development, which turn and changes in learning patterns, behavior, beliefs, and cognitions, identity, development, self-worth, and relations with others, and anything else in common. They're stuck emotionally at the age of, boom, a certain age. Okay, let's establish something right from the beginning. This is a brain. All men have brains. All women have brains, okay? Sometimes we get into debates about that, but you'll see this in a minute. The human brain. Okay, everybody put your hand on the left side of the brain. Okay, this is the analytical, linear, explicit, sequential, verbal. This is your verbal side, the rational side. This is the goal-oriented. It controls the language and reading skills. It analyzes and takes things apart. It's more concerned with the outer world. It calms the emotional side when it's working. In trauma, it has less ability to do its job. Trauma can freeze your thinking ability. Now we have the right side. This is the spontaneous, intuitive, emotional side, the nonverbal, the visual, artistic. Women are stronger, but men are stronger with the spatial side. It's a picture element. It doesn't have words. It stores memories as pictures. This is the alarm side. This is the side you dream on. Trauma hypersensitizes it. It overreacts like the alarm system of a car that keeps going off. This is where post-traumatic stress disorder pictures come from. And traumatic memories is like a series of snapshots or silent movie. There's no music or words. But for those of us who are involved in counseling, we want to put words and music to the pictures. And that way the person can function the way they're supposed to. Okay, let's talk about the nerve connectors. On the right side, this is the woman's brain. Women have 20 to 40% more nerve connectors that are thicker, and they use their brain holistically. This is why you ladies are capable of talking on the phone, reading a recipe, dealing with a child, cooking something, and calling to your husband in the other room and saying, "Honey, Jimmy is setting fire to the floor. Will you check on him?" And the husband puts down the paper, looks over, and says, "Yes, he's setting fire to the floor," and goes back and reads the newspaper again. He did what you asked him. You'll see this on the right, the woman's brain, all those thick nerve connectors. It's like a giant freeway system. On the left is the man. It's like a one-lane dirt road between his two sides. Now, about 25% of men are what we call bridge brains. They are more, their brain is more like a woman's brain than a man. It's just the way the DNA ended up. But also there's other things that can occur here. For example, I tend to be like this. But I had 10 years of classical piano training with the left and the right hand, and I still play the piano. And when I sit down to play, I don't think about the right hand is going to do this and the left hand this. It just does. You know, I can't explain it. I mean, it just goes together. Well, that's a characteristic of this. This is why it's so important for parents to get their children into music at an early age, especially the keyboard, because they do anywhere from 30 to 35% better in their other studies because you've activated both the left and the right side of the brain. So when school districts cut back and they say, "We're cutting back on music," no, that's the last thing you want to cut back on, and you need to talk to the folks there. But anyway, there are differences between a woman's brain and a man's brain. Like, there are different lobes. We men have different lobes, like the remote addiction lobe. You know, lobe that is there. The sports lobe. There's the Michelob. No, that's a different one. Michelob there. But there are other lobes, such as, for men, there's what we call the nothing lobe. And the wife says, "Honey, what are you thinking about? Nothing. What do you mean nothing? You can't think about nothing. You got to be thinking about something." Well, it's true. We do have those nothing lobes, and there's nothing going on at that time. So anyway, okay. Here's where we get to what we can do to help somebody in grief and loss. This might be you we're talking about here. But it could be you're going to file this away and say, I can use this when I try to help other individuals. And the first thing is, identify and engage supportive and caring people. We need others in our life to help us recover. Those who live out Romans 12:15. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Okay, so if I were working with you, I would make a list. Because if you work with people who are in grief, everything's got to be written down because they're going to walk out of the room and forget everything that you said. Why? Because they're in grief. That's why. So, make a list of those people that you want to help you. Then you make a list of those people you do not want involved in your life. It could be some relatives, it could be some friends. It's all right to do that because those people wound you. That's what happens. They will wound you. And what helps is to come up with a phrase and write it out and put it by the phone. So when one of those people call that you don't want to help you, you can read it off and not try to think about it because when you're in grief, you don't think good, you don't remember good. So you can say, well, thank you for your suggestion. I'll think about it and let you know. That's what I'm going to recommend. And they say, well, let me come on over and help. Well, I'll think about it. And then I'll let you know. Just repeat the words, word for word, everything you wrote down before, and do that 3 or 4 times. You will stay in control, and they can't budge you from that. That is important that you surround yourself with those that can help. Recognize and accept who or what you have lost. If a loved one died, recognize and accept they are unable to return. It's going to take a long time if it was a child's death or a traumatic death. I've had so many people that say, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 months, I wake up in the morning and it's like, no, this isn't real. But yes, it is. It takes a while for that to sink in. Why? Because we don't want to have it happen. That's why. Experience all the emotions associated with the loss. Do not try to just put a lid on them. This is something that we have used for years. It's in several of the books. I found it from a hospital down in Newport 40 years ago. And this describes what grief is. A tangled ball of emotion. And one of the best things you can do is to have a copy of this and every day go through it and say, okay, this is where I'm at. I'm in panic. I have confusion. I have rage. I have anger. And go back to it every day because our emotions change. One of the best things you can do is use it with a family. I was working with a family who lost their 22-year-old on a skateboard because a hit-and-run driver hit it and took off. And so it was mom and dad. Dad was a correction officer. And there were 3 teenage boys, typical guys. It was a Hispanic family, and mom and dad were pretty articulate, and the 3 boys were, yep, nope, yep. So I sent 5 copies home. This is about 2 months into the counseling. And so one night after dinner, dad said, okay, we're all going to sit down. I got highlighters here. I got crayons here. We're all going to take some of those colors, and we're going to take a ball of grief, we're going to just write out and color in where we are. And when they came in the next week, Dad said, we spent over an hour, couldn't get those kids to quit talking. And I noticed a difference in the counseling session. They were much more open, they were much more articulate because they had identified their feelings and now this, we had normalized for them what they were feeling. And you can do this once a week, once a month, whatever. That will help you identify what is going on. Now, I want to tackle though some feelings. Okay, there's another one. This is what we call the blob tree. And I downloaded this off of the internet. And basically what it is you identify the different family members and where they are. And I was working with a high school boy. He had not said much in about 3 months. And I gave him this. And he was coloring this all over and drawing lines and whatnot. And he started talking and wouldn't shut up. And if you do this once a month, you find a new change and you're in different places, and it's mom and dad and children, etc. And it just helps you identify what this is all about. Okay. What can you do with anger, depression, and worry? Okay, anger. Are you aware that anger is a secondary emotion? And there are three major causes to anger. Fear, hurt, and frustration. And so, when you're angry, what really helps is to go back to what's causing it. And I know family members that have worked with their children like this. And so, when the child gets angry, they come to the parent and say, "Dad, I am frustrated and angry." "Really? Well, tell me about your frustration." And you get down to the cause. You get down to the core. Worry. Worry is a big factor. I don't know why it is over the years I've drawn what I call professional worriers. I've had people come in and say, "Norm, I have worried for so long that I'm really good at it. And I don't think there's anything that you can do to change it." So instead of hitting them head on, I say, "You know, I agree. I don't think there is anything I can do to change your work. I think I can do something, though. I think I can help you get more out of it." "What do you mean?" "Well, I've noticed that you worry throughout the day. You don't get the most out of it this time. And it would be far better if you would take a 3x5 card, and every time you worry, just write it down. Don't worry at this particular point, but just write it down. And every day at 4 o'clock, you go into the room, take out that card, and you worry as hard as you can do it. And you do that until 4:30, and then you put it away because you worry for the day. What do you think about that?" I have one guy say, "I can't believe I'm paying you what I'm paying you to hear that stuff." And another guy said, "Norm, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard you say." I said, "Yeah, I know. How is it any different than what you're doing?" "Oh. Well, there are things we can do about worry. Your first name is?
Tukia.
Is what?
Tukia.
Tukia?
Tukia.
Tukia. Okay, Tukia just came to see me and she's been struggling with worry. So, Tukia, I want you to take a 3x5 card. On one side, Tukia, write the word stop. Okay? On the other side, I want you to write the passage of scripture in Philippians 4. 6-9. Don't worry about anything, but in everything with prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known to God." Okay? That's what it's saying right there. And it goes on from there. Let's look at it. If you do this, you'll experience God's peace, which is far more wonderful than the human mind can understand. His peace will keep your thoughts and your hearts quiet and at rest as you trust in Christ Jesus. Fix your thoughts on what is pure and good and right. Think about things that are pure and lovely and dwell on the fine good things in others. Think about all you can praise God for and be glad about. Keep putting it into practice. Practice means do it again and again and again. Keep putting it into practice all you learned from me and saw me doing, and God of peace will be with you. So, again, you're at home and nobody's around. And you've got that card with you and you get the word. Take the card out. Hold it in front of you and say the word stop twice. Stop! Stop! Turn it over and read Philippians 4, 6-9 out loud twice. Okay? When you're out socially, you're at church, you're at Target, you're out someplace, and you begin to worry, do the very same thing. Take it out, read it. This time, do one thing different. Do not read it out loud. Okay? You do. You got a lot to worry about. Okay? And see, here's what happens. Taking the card out interrupts the worry battery. Saying the word stop brings it to a halt. But we can't exist with our mind in the void of our vacuum. So what you do is you fill it with God's word. You do that often enough, it will make a change. There are thousands of card-carrying worriers in the country today. I've shared this for years, and it makes a difference. I was teaching a class in Long Beach at the Bethany Baptist. I was teaching on worry. And the next week I said, "Did anybody try out the car?" 12 hands went up. There's a lady right where you're sitting. I said, "I don't know you, but you said you wrote it out. Tell us what happened." She said, "Well, I didn't write it out Sunday, So Monday morning, I wrote it out, and by 4 o'clock Monday afternoon, I pulled the card out 20 times. Friday of this week, on that day, I pulled the card out twice. I have struggled with worry for years, never had the hope I could overcome. For the first time in my life, I had hope. That's what can happen. You're putting the Word of God in, but you're practicing it. You're repetitive. You're doing it again and again. Okay. Use a grief recovery journal. Many people do this. And the best way is long-handed, because that is bringing more of a healing to the brain. The answer machine. Okay. Let me introduce you to Dave. Dave lost his wife of 35 years. And he started coming through counseling about 3 months. And if you called Dave during the week, you'd hear, "Hi, this is Dave. I'm having a difficult time. All the plans that Irene and I had together are gone because she's died. Pray for me that I will be able to do such and such." And here's a passage of scripture. So the next week, you call Dave again. It's a totally different message. You do this the third week, and it's a different message. In fact, you do this for 4 years. And every week, there's a different message from Dave. And all his friends caught on and purposely started calling him when he was at work so he could get Dave's message. And Dave was sharing in his own way, probably do it on Facebook differently now, but this is the way he did it. Not only was he sharing, he was teaching all those that heard him what the journey of grief was like. And I asked him to write it out because it was a great book. So it's a great way. Write your own song of lament based on that book that I mentioned. Use pictures, videos, and stories to elicit feelings. Don't deny your feelings. And never, never apologize for your feelings. I sure don't, because why should I apologize for something that is a gift from God? How to handle intrusive thoughts. Let me tell you what not to do. Try to think of something else. Try to keep it out of your mind. Get up and go in another room. Talking to somebody about anything other than the incident. Having a drink of alcohol. These are things that don't work. Taking other drugs. These do work. Effective coping strategies. Acknowledge the memory at a distance. Yes, that happened. Stopping the rumination. Rumination is worry. Daring to mention the trauma. Invite it in. That traumatic thought comes in and you're thinking, "Oh no, here you are again. You're on the neck. But I've handled you before. And so, come on in. I can handle you again. But this time it's going to be a little different. Before it's been you and me. This time it's going to be you and I and our Lord Jesus. And I'm going to give you to Him. And He will take care of you." And that very act just breaks part of the hole that is going on with that intrusive thought. Dictate the story of the trauma and its effects. But again, this is telling the story. Rereading the story at a special time. Writing about it and its consequences at a special time. It helps to write and dictate the trauma in concrete terms and detail. Reading this at a special time can put you in charge of the trauma. And it's just sort of shifting who's in control, you or I. Well, it can work. Identify regrets and unfinished issues and take steps to resolve them. I talked about what to do about regrets earlier. Write a letter. Sometimes articulating our thoughts and feelings in letter form helps us understand them better. Write a letter to the person who died, telling her how you feel now that she's gone. Consider the following prompts. What I miss about you is, what I wish I had said or hadn't said is, what's hardest for me now is, What I'd like to ask you is, I'm keeping my memories of you alive by, and you just finish each of those. And once you have done that, there's a different dynamic that's going on inside of you. Again, I can't always explain why some of this stuff works. Some things don't work better more with one person. Some works better. I don't know. Read your letter aloud at the cemetery or any other sacred place you think appropriate. Another healing exercise can be writing a letter to yourself on behalf of the person who died. Imagine that the person who died is writing you from heaven. What would she say to you? How would she want you to live the rest of your life? That's different. Write a letter to God telling him how you feel about the dead. Write thank you notes to helpers such as hospice staff, neighbors, doctors, funeral directors, etc. Find a place to store the memories of your loved one which will honor them and help you move on. Okay, let me go back to Dave. One day, Dave came into my office and said, Norm, I'm going to write 1,000 one-liners. And by now, I knew that this guy was doing something really off the wall. And I said, okay, Dave, what are 1,000 one-liners? Well, every time I have a memory of my wife Irene, I will write it on a card. And when I get to 1,000 of these, I will stop. Because by then I think I've remembered everything I want to remember. You see, memories are really all we have left. And that's why it's so important to capture them. Because right now they might be painful because they're so fresh and vivid and alive. But guess what? A year from now, those memories will have faded. They're kind of foggy, and you wish you could grasp the reality of them like they used to be there. Put your relationship with what or who you lost on a line, lifeline. Write a story of your relationship with them. How did they enhance your life? How are you different because of them? Give memories. God honors and embraces the memories of Luke 22:17-19. Change your relationship to who or what you've lost and your investment to what or who is lost. Begin when you're ready to reinvest. Who are you now without your loved one? That's important. Use an explanation letter. Okay, this can be really helpful. Because sometimes you get weary telling people what's going on in your life. You know, you're tired of saying the same thing again and again. So what you do is you write a letter. Dear friend, family, pastor, fellow worker, recently I suffered a devastating loss. I am grieving and it will take months and even years to recover from this loss. There's a message there. Don't try to fix me. Don't try to make me move on. I wanted to let you know that I will cry from time to time. I don't apologize for my tears since they are not a sign of weakness or a lack of faith. They are God's gift to me to express the extent of my loss, and they are also a sign that I am recovering. At times you may see me angry for no apparent reason. Sometimes I'm not sure why. All I know is that my emotions are intense because of my grief. If I don't always make sense to you, please be forgiving and patient with me. And if I repeat myself again and again, please accept this as normal. More than anything else, I need your understanding and your presence. You don't always have to know what to say, or even say anything, if you don't know how to respond. Your presence and a touch or a hug lets me know that you care. Please don't wait for me to call you, since sometimes I am too tired or fearful to do so. If I tend to withdraw from you, please don't let me do that. I need you to reach out to me for several months. Pray for me that I would come to see meaning in my loss someday and that I would know God's comfort and love. It does help me to know that you are praying for me. If you've experienced a similar type of loss, please feel free to share it with me. It will help rather than cause me to feel worse And don't stop sharing if I begin to cry. It's all right, and any tears you express as we talk are all right as well. This loss is so painful, and right now it feels like the worst thing that could ever happen to me. But I will survive and eventually recover. I cling to that knowledge, even though there are times when I didn't feel it. I know that I will not always feel as I do now. Laughter and joy will emerge once again someday. Thank you for caring about me. Thank you for listening and praying. Your concern comforts me and is a gift which I will always be grateful for. And you write this letter out, and when people ask, how are you doing? Thank you for asking. That's all you got to do. Use the empty chair. Sometimes it helps to put the person's name in an empty chair and talk to the chair as if they were there. And never put a timetable on your grief. I found this little chart, and during the first 2-3 months, people respond to you with care, concern, and comfort, and help, and empathy. And where are they now at 3 months or 6 months? Or at 1 year? They're not there. And you'll notice the intensity of the loss at about 3 months, which usually occurs, and then at 1 year. And it helps to keep this in mind, that everybody is different. I can't explain why it happens in 3 months. I had 3 phone calls last week because it was 3 months. And people are wondering, what's going on? And many times when I show that chart, afterwards somebody comes up and says, why didn't they warn me? It's the 1 year anniversary next week. And I thought I was going crazy, and you're telling me I'm normal. Why didn't somebody tell me that? That's a good question. You need to watch out for triggers or ambushes. Could be a song, could be a sight, anything. And you gotta learn to say goodbye. And sometimes it helps to go into each room of the house and talk as though the person were there and then wave goodbye. People do this when they retire. They get outside of the place and they wave goodbye because that very act, for some reason, just makes a difference. And then use worship to help you grieve. I have a favorite songwriter, Terry Clark, who has written all these worship songs. And after my son died, I would go in my office and I would either turn on the CD or I would get the Maranatha music that accompanies the nature scenes, and I would put that on, or I would cry in worship service if I'm depressed, because worship is a wonderful time when we can say goodbye. Where's my helper? There's a book back there. If you wouldn't mind bringing it to me, because there's a quote in it. The Handbook of Grief, Helping Others in Grief, is sort of beige and brown and paperback. Do you have it there? Is that a counseling book? That's it. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, there's a quote there. And then I want to close with one picture. Thank you very much.
You're so very welcome.
I was counseling Highway Patrol officer. He had retired so that he and his wife could go and travel. He'd been working 20 years. 3 months after he retired, she died. She had a 19-year illness. He was not the most articulate. Sometimes his grammar wasn't the best, and he had low self-esteem and whatnot. And I encouraged him to write. And so the first thing he wrote, he brought into me, and I read it. I said, where did you get this? I wrote it. You wrote this? Yeah. It's like it was a different man inside of him when he wrote. And then the next thing he wrote, I said, do I have your permission to put this in a book? Me? Something I wrote? Yeah. Is it okay? Sure. This is part of what he wrote. Through these past few months, I prayed many prayers, and there were many prayers prayed on my behalf by family and friends. However, none of them seemed to have reached the ear of God. Then one day when I was in my hour of deepest depression and isolation, I began to pray a very simple prayer. Lord, you know my needs. All I ask is that you provide a single healing stitch to my heart once a day. I know that over time, while the scar in my heart will always remain, the healing can begin. That is so profound. Many times since I read this to a counselee, and I would call my wife, say, Dwight, let me tell you what happened when I read your statement. You mean you shared that with somebody? Yeah. And they responded like that? Yeah. Wow. And see how the journey of grief in one can minister to another. I like to grow flowers. I've got a dozen roses. I've got delphiniums, columbine, hydrangeas. I like to see the new life. And it's so important that when you're in grief, you have something that just sort of shows you that there is new life out there. Maybe a newborn baby. Maybe the flowers that you bring in. Maybe an animal. I have this picture right next to my office. I don't know how they ever got it. It was on the cover of the Golden Retriever Journal. But it just reminds me there is new life. Lord Jesus, you understand grief. You gave us the gift of your life that we might have new life. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for understanding the grief that we go through. We just pray that we would continue to grow. Apply your word. Give us rest at night as we endeavor to sleep. We just pray that as the weeks go on and the months go on, that the grief will live, and that through these losses and through this grief, we might learn, we might grow. And Father, we ask that you bring somebody into our life that we can share with, so that they know the joy of the Lord. Your comfort. We ask in your name. Amen. Thank you for your desire to grow and to minister to others. If you're picking up or if you're ordering any of the books, if you could just leave that back there, just check off the books that you want. There's another form that we have back there that you can read, because over the years we've had a number of individuals who have wanted to take training, and sometimes you can't go to a class, so we do it by the reading, by the watching of the DVDs, and that way we can give you a certificate that you've had some training. And then if at any time you get any questions, I think you've got my email address, don't hesitate, it might take me a day or two to get back to you. I try to respond to everything, but thank you for your heart.